Today's episode of Robinson Podcast is sponsored by SeatGeek. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and then try to sneak in a huge fee at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concerts tickets. You know, I've just been on SeatGeek. I've got it on my phone. I wanted to check out, where can I get Chase Rice tickets this summer? Well, SeatGeek is the answer. Because this podcast today is all about negotiation on Survivor and the best ways to negotiate a deal for something. No need when you've got SeatGeek, because SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available from other sites into one place so you save time and never miss a deal. And even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And best of all, SeatGeek is honest and upfront about the price. Unlike some other sites, SeatGeek gives you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you or blindsides you with a huge fee at checkout. Our listeners can get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, click on the settings tab, and click add a promo code. Enter the promo code Rob, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. So download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code Rob today. Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Sestrino back here with another one of our Survivor Summer Series of podcasts. And today we have a podcast that I'm actually very excited about because we are not going to be doing a particular deep dive into Survivor history or even the last past season that we just saw or editing or anything like that. We are going to be taking a look at a crucial Survivor skill, which is negotiations. And I think that this is going to be a podcast which is going to reap benefits for you, whether you are playing Survivor or whether you are using it in your everyday life. And here to join us, we have a great guest here with us today. Of course, you could hear him on the Genius Cast with Scott and Mike, that he has taught negotiations at Harvard Law School. Welcome, Michael Botta. Michael, how are you?
I'm good. Hey, Rob. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here, Michael. First time that we have done a podcast together, but you come highly recommended.
That's right. I'm not on the Price is Right like some people, but I'll take it.
Yeah. All right. Well, Michael, very excited to get into this and talk about this because I am looking forward to getting a bit of an education on this. And of course, we'll tie in all the different ways that survivors have used or misused some of these tactics that we're going to talk about today. First off, could you just tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the field of negotiations?
Sure. I guess I've always been fascinated by it. And I think, so growing up in New York, I was a big haggler. Go shop on Canal Street and try to just argue with people for a fake watch for hours. And I just really enjoyed doing things like that. I got to grad school and learned that actually being good at negotiation was very different from what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So I thought it'd be worth actually learning how the pros do it and what would actually make you good at it. Because you know, as somebody who loves Survivor and has been watching for a long time, I realized that you know, the people who were successful at Survivor were the ones who sort of treated it like an art form and knew how to listen well, understand what other people wanted, and could parlay that into figuring out how to get what they wanted. So it turns out that's good for not just Survivor, but actually life, and it has been a pretty valuable skill for me so far. I loved learning it, started teaching it, and now it's a big part of my job every day.
So was your interest in negotiation what led you into having an interest in Survivor?
No, I'd say I was probably interested in both of them for a long time before. So I'm Survivor fan since season one. I've been an annoying haggler since I was a little kid. They just both come together really well.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to get into talking about this topic. Can you just get into a little bit of what sort of things that you would teach in a course on negotiation?
So it depends where you take it. Lots of different schools have different versions. At Harvard, there's a negotiation workshop that most students do. Weirdly enough, I was there at the same time when I was teaching. Cochran was there in law school, but he did not take the class. So take it or leave it, I guess. Maybe you don't need it. But at Harvard, it's the negotiation workshop, and you can find pretty similar things at schools, business schools, public policy schools, law schools all around the country. And then for the most part, people tend to draw from a few standard books that are sort of classics in the field, which we can talk about as we get into it.
Cool. Well, I'm very excited to have you here to talk through all of this stuff here. So why don't we just start off with an overview of what we're going to get into here on the podcast?
Sure. So what I thought would be useful is to take three of the sort of fundamental negotiation lessons that exist in the academic study of negotiation from some of like the classic books that you can buy on Amazon, things like Getting to Yes and some of the others. So take those three sort of fundamental lessons and then apply them to the game of Survivor. And for each of these lessons, what I'll do is give an explanation of what it means, sort of where it comes from, how you might want to think about applying it in real life, and then let's apply it to Survivor. So we can think about an example where the lesson was applied very well and an example where it was applied not so well, and get a sense of what's good and what's bad and how you see that play out in the game.
Great. I love it. All right. So anything else in terms of an overview before we jump into lesson number one?
Sure. One thing that I think everybody should know is even if you're not interested in negotiation, like you're not a lawyer, you're not a business person out there negotiating big deals, I think it's a really beneficial thing to know just for life. Because pretty much everything is negotiation. I mean, Rob, you can speak to this really well. If you've got little kids, pretty much every day is a negotiation with little kids. If you're married,
right? Does this apply to potty training? Because I find myself negotiating a lot of things for pee-pee on the potty right now.
I mean, you'll learn something, I hope. Let's see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of this, we're going to be talking about learning your kids' interests, discussing options, and then you can always just fire them at the end of it if it doesn't work out. I think that's how it works.
Good. Probably more useful in my marriage if you find that I'm making a lot of negotiations. Although I find that my wife tends to often just go back on whatever we've negotiated. And if you mention the negotiation that was had, she gets really mad. So maybe we can talk about how we can get through that as we go along. All right.
I'll say I'm planning my wedding right now. So mm-hmm. pretty much every day is a negotiation.
Yeah.
Learned that flowers are really expensive. Who knew?
Michael, let's jump into talking about this first lesson.
Let's do it. Okay, so lesson one, it's all about the BATNA. So BATNA, not a real word, but it's the most important concept in negotiation.
Okay.
It's an acronym, BATNA, and it stands for the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And so the BATNA is pretty much the fundamental concept of negotiation. And you can explain it pretty simply. It basically means you need to know what all of your options are. So if you're in a negotiation, fundamentally, you need to understand if we don't come to an agreement, so if this negotiation doesn't work out, what's my best alternative? And this is pretty much a simple concept, but it's important to keep it in mind, in the heat of battle, so to speak. You should always know that you should try to come to an agreement if the agreement's going to be better than your best alternative, but you shouldn't come to an agreement if it's going to be worse than your best alternative. So something important to keep in mind there is if you're doing this well, you not only need to understand your own best alternative, but you need to understand the other person's best alternative too.
Mm-hmm.
And that might mean lots of things. So if you understand yours really well, there are some times where you might walk away from a deal, even though there's a lot of, you might've put a lot of work into it. You might've spent a lot of time figuring out the right way to think it through. But if ultimately you realize that that deal is not as good as what your alternatives are, you shouldn't do it. The same thing for your opponents. But sometimes you can try to convince them that it's a better deal than they might think. Try to get them to make a decision based more on emotion than on logic. There are lots of things that people do, but ultimately it comes down to that. You should do your homework, understand what your best options are, what your opponent's best options are, and in most circumstances, if you're dealing with a rational person, if you're not dealing with, the Phillips of the world, you should assume that your opponents are going to choose their best option, which should help you figure out what to put on the table, how to structure something, and how to think it through logically.
Okay, well, this is great, first off, because BATNA sounds like it could be its own Survivor tribe name, so that's perfect.
From Survivor the 33, tribe. Millennials versus BATNA.
Yeah, or at least a good merge tribe name. I think BATNA might be.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be somebody's mom's name spelled backwards.
Yes, so my mom, Aunt Tab.
That's right. She's lovely. She's a lovely lady.
I guess you could have an Aunt Tab. That might be a shout out to her, your Aunt Tab. But also, fantasy football season is right around the corner, and that's where I find this stuff particularly useful.
Yeah, I'm a horrible person to play fantasy football with. I'm also really bad at Settlers of Catan. I'm a huge pain in the ass to play Settlers of Catan with. I'll sit there for hours.
Like, trying to make a deal.
Yeah, what's your best? I think this is better. I'm going to give you something terrible, but it's better than what you've got.
Let's yeah. So in terms of trying to figure out your opponent's best alternative, I mean, how do you get in that headspace of being able to figure out what your opponent's best moves are when you don't have all the information about them?
Yeah, it's a great question. A lot of times it comes down to, you know, in Survivor or in life, doing as much homework as you can, talking to other people, understanding the landscape. So just knowing who's out there, like who are their other choices that they might make a deal with? Do they have good relationships with those people? Do they have bad relationships? You're always dealing with imperfect information, but you're going to try to collect as much of it as you can and get yourself into a headspace where you have, if you were them, what do you think they would want to do?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard though. I mean, you're dealing with people who think differently than you do. You know, they might have, you know, different perspectives, different worldviews. So it's definitely a challenge. What some of the best negotiators do is they look at ways to either make people's other alternatives better or worse. So you try to make your own alternatives better or try to make other people's alternatives worse. And you can do that by genuinely making them worse. Like you can actually do something to eliminate options for someone else. Or, I mean, just as good, you can make their perception of their alternatives worse. I remember one of your interviews with Boston Rob, he tried to talk about something like this, which was to say, it doesn't necessarily matter exactly what somebody's options are. It matters what they think their options are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get them thinking that they have worse options than they actually have, you're in a great position. Somebody else who is known for being particularly good at this on Survivor is someone like Sandra, who I remember there's a Tyson cast from a couple of years ago talking about heroes versus villains, where Tyson points out that Sandra's really good at putting it in your head that other people are scheming against you. She can take somebody's words, you know, twist them just right and make you think that someone who might be an option to work with isn't actually a good option to work with because they've got it out for you just like everybody else does.
In the real world where you're sort of going through this, like what's the best way to sort of work out what your options are? Like, do you recommend that, like, should you be doing it like on paper or do you have like a system for figuring out what your best options are?
Definitely on paper. Like I'd start, you know, get a piece of paper out, get a spreadsheet and get some friends involved too. Like it's always helpful to think about this with multiple people. So to whatever extent you can, just start writing things down. You might realize as you're doing that, you'll think of options that you didn't immediately recognize were there, but might be pretty good. Or you might start listing things down. And when you think about how, you know, feasible they are, how excited you'd be about them, you realize actually these are pretty bad and I damn well better come up with a negotiated agreement here or else I'm in bad shape.
Going back to the Sandra thing, when you talk about how you want to explore the potential other options outside of working with you or going with your proposed deal, how do you do that with somebody and not have them end up hating your guts? I mean, what is it that you see or you've seen Sandra do in terms of being able to shoot down other alternatives that don't make it just seem like, oh my God, that this person is just trying to criticize my other options because they want me to go with them?
I think this will lead, when we get to the second case, it'll lead really well into some things that people do effectively in that lesson.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say what Sandra does really well is she's really clear about what her interests are and she tries to frame things in terms of what other people's interests are. So if you're talking about something in terms of like, here's what's important to me, as opposed to saying like, this person's out to get you, we got to get them out. It's much more compelling to hear something that says, oh, you know what? That's important to me too. Or she's right. That is something that's really important to me. So now let me keep listening to what she's going to say. And it'll feel like I'm making my own decision because it's based around what I'm interested in, not what she's telling me to do. And that turns out to be extremely effective on Survivor and in life.
Could you give me some more examples from Survivor so that I want to make sure I'm wrapping my head around this and getting this concept down perfect?
Sure. Yeah. So let's talk a good example and a bad example. So one good example that comes to mind is if we go back to the first Survivor Blood versus Water season, take us down to the moment where we're going to get to our rock draw, which is a pretty iconic moment.
Sure. In final
that
six.
First Survivor season. Exactly. I'd say both Hayden and Sierra do a great job of putting this concept into action. So Hayden is working really hard to save himself. And he's looking around the room and saying, of the people who are left, what are their options? And he can see you know, Jervis, Monica, Tyson all have pretty good options in front of them. Whereas Sierra, her options aren't actually all that great.
Mm-hmm.
She has, you know, she perceives them to be pretty good. She thinks she's solid in an alliance. I think what Hayden realizes is she's actually not in a particularly great position in that alliance. And if she can make that clear, so if she can, you know, weaken Sierra's perception of her alternatives, he can be in a great position to get her to, you know, make a move.
And just to set the stage a little bit there for people that might not have that season down like a lot of other people might. So in the final six of the Blood versus Water, you had Tyson and Jervis and Monica. We're in a three-person alliance, but at the same time, Tyson and Jervis were also trying to feed Sierra that she was also in the third person in that alliance, and Monica wasn't the third person, even though Monica truly was the third person in that alliance. And then Hayden was still there, that Caleb was his sort of close ally in the game. He had just been voted out at the final seven. Katie is still also in the mix and is sort of like this straggler who's left around, and they're trying to get her to be the third person in some sort of three-person alliance with them, trying to prove that she is not the third person with Jervis and Tyson. She is the fourth behind Monica going into that vote.
Yeah, that's a perfect setup. And I think what we see is Hayden does a great job of understanding alternatives, and then Sierra does a fantastic job. I think one of the things that gets, you know, you can look at it based on the outcome, which is that it doesn't really work out. Sierra is not able to turn the game upside down, but she made a great decision, which is that she looked at what are her options, and she realized if she sticks with the alliance, based on the information she has, she's actually not in a very good spot. So even though it feels risky, or it's a scary move in Survivor to jump ship from your alliance and move over to play with somebody else, it feels like, you know, making a deal with the devil. But for Sierra, she realized it was actually a better option than her existing alternatives. So she made the move. And whether it worked out or not, you got to say that, you know, if you're willing to make those moves at the right time, that's good negotiating. It's good decision making.
Well, it really worked out in a lot of great ways for Sierra. One, to take that leap of faith to go with Hayden and Katie rather than to go with the Tyson, Jervis, Monica thing. Kind of Jervis does a pretty bad job, too, of really just laying out, no, Sierra, you're going to be fourth. So she kind of had nothing to lose. It's sort of like, if I go with them, I'm going to lose almost no matter what, barring some sort of like huge immunity run or anything like that. Whereas I have a shot to win the game if I go with this move, even though it's a gamble. And then by doing so, and who knows if this was part of her thought process or not, where I'm going to establish myself as this big risk-taking character who has earned her way back into all-star contention as a Survivor player.
And you know, Jeff Probst loves people who make big moves.
Yeah, she's a riverboat gambler.
Yeah. Sometimes you can do that in a way where the big move actually makes sense. And that's sort of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, but I feel like that with some of these Survivor things, where if the choice is make the safe move or make the big move, unless you feel like the safe move is definitely going to help you win the game, kind of feel like make the big move because there are dividends that it could pay down the road.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That's sort of the John Cochran school of Survivor playing also.
Well, yeah, we really talked about that when we did the evolution of strategy from Survivor South Pacific, where it's sort of like, okay, make the big move, at least in your first time, because at the very least, you kind of almost ensure you get invited back a second time when you're known for making some sort of crazy move.
Yeah, exactly. And it sort of shows folks that you're going to make good decisions, too. So if you are shown to be a strategic thinker, somebody who weighs all the options, it's tremendously helpful in both the discussions you're going to have with people on the island and just them knowing that you're a logical person who's going to do, you know, something that makes sense, which is really what you want in your allies.
And I don't mean to take us down the rabbit hole that is oddly specific to Survivor casting, where people who make sort of like big electric moves tend to get invited back for all-star seasons. I don't know if that necessarily is, there's a corollary in the business world of people who make a big splash are necessarily also the kind of people that you want to be in business with. But I do think that there's a little bit of that, where we talked about in the 49 Laws of Survivor of, you know, the make compelling spectacles. You know, that there is something that you do want to make work with somebody who does have that kind of track record, right?
Yeah, there's a guy who seems to talk about making a lot of huge moves who seems to have done some things in business.
Yeah, people are impressed with that.
Yeah, who knows, but someone like that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an interesting one in terms of that final six. Are there any examples where people butchered this?
Yeah. And butcher is a good word to think about here, because I'm thinking of a scenario where somebody chopped something in a way that caused them some real trouble.
Yes.
So if I go back to Survivor Marquesas.
Okay. Oh, I thought you were talking about Butch from Survivor the Amazon and chopping wood.
We need more. We need more. Believe in yourself. Come on. But going back one season before that to John Carroll and thinking about in the eighth episode of Marquesas, we get down to a reward challenge. And just to split it out, we've got a tight group of four. So the row two, four at the time, John Carroll and his alliance. So John, let's see, Tammy, the general, Zoe, if I think that's right.
Yeah.
The four of them are working together tightly, and they're also working with Pascal and Aaliyah, but Pascal and Aaliyah sort of on the bottom. The thing that's really helping the row two, four and John in particular are that Pascal and Aaliyah haven't quite figured that out yet. So they don't exactly know that they have a better alternative than what's in front of them. They think that everything is great. They have no reason to think that any of the alternatives in front of them would be better than what they're currently doing. Mm-hmm. What John does is he goes and, you know, very helpfully for them, shows them that they've got a much better alternative in front of them. So the immunity challenge, for, you know, folks to remember this, is set up with, you've got a bunch of trivia questions to answer. And if you answer one correctly, you can chop a coconut. Every other player has coconuts. When their coconuts are gone, they're out of the challenge. Mm-hmm. So the row 2-4 basically chop coconuts in exactly the elimination order that they're hoping for. They eliminate, you know, everyone who is not in their alliance, then everyone who is sort of weakly in their alliance, and leave themselves together.
Yeah.
Very helpful for showing Pascal and Aaliyah that they've got another option, which is to pair with all those other folks who are not in the row 2-4. They go ahead and do that. And very soon, John is going home.
It's interesting because that you have the row 2 tribe, which was sort of like this love tribe, they called themselves. And so you had, you where people who were in that row 2-4 were sort of just counting on that Pascal and Aaliyah were just going to stay loyal with them down to the bitter end. They didn't need to necessarily show them that they had this other option. And we talk about this so much as we have sort of like a really developed sense of Survivor endgame strategy, where you sort of like need to even tell the people on the bottom, hey, your best move is to go with me. We've seen different players like Boston Rob and Kim Spradlin and Brian Heidick do this really well, for the people on the bottom sort of selling them on this idea that, oh no, your best alternative is to stay with me because you're going to a final two or a final three with me, as opposed to when these other sort of like bottom feeders come along and say like, hey, let's make a new final five. It's like, why would I go with your final five? I'm going to the final three with Kim. Why am I going to go off with you, Troy-Zan, or something like that? So I think that that's really important to sort of get those people that are at the bottom of your alliance, the people that are really the five, sixes, and sevens, get them enrolled in a way that they're feeling like that they're a top three. So they're buying into some sort of best alternative, which is not even a real one.
Yeah, exactly. So
bait and switch.
Yeah, always be thinking about what their real best alternatives are and offer them something better than their best alternative.
Even
if it's fake. That's how you want to make sure that people aren't going to flip.
I like that. Now, are you advising people to come up with fake alternatives to sell people in any seminars that you're teaching?
That's right. I've got like a steaks company that you can buy into. I got a water company. I got a little bit of everything here. I'm all about honesty. So I'm also not playing Survivor right here. I definitely think honesty is the best policy. And I would say to folks, life, actually much like Survivor, is sort of a series of repeat negotiations. If you see somebody today, you're probably going to see them again later. You're probably going to have something to negotiate with them for later as well. You know, if it's in the business world, if you're negotiating a contract this year, you probably have to renegotiate it next year or the year after. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to do it by lying and snowing people, it's not going to go over next year when somebody tells them, actually, you know, I never would have taken the contract away for you, or that guy completely made that up. They're not going to be willing to work with you in the future. And Survivor's pretty similar, right? So if you vote somebody out based on completely fake information, unless you come up with a really great jury speech, they're probably not going to vote for you at the end of the game.
Yeah.
So repeat negotiations are super important, and honesty is always going to be the best policy in dealing with those.
Okay, so that's really the rub in all of this.
Yep.
I mean, if you're just telling people anything, then sure, you could get away with it. That's sort of like the Russell Hance model, but you need to be able to do this sort of artfully where you can sort of sell people this, but leave yourself enough room where they still like you enough at the end where they're going to vote for you.
Yeah, or if you really want to be Russell, just be Russell with the pre-jury members, and then you're fine.
Then you're fine.
Yeah, then you're fine.
People. Yeah, you're never going to see again.
If you take one lesson from this podcast, it's pre-jury, go full Hants all mm-hmm. day.
All right. So is there anything else about the BATNA that you want to get into?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary of it. I'd say just always know your options and know everybody else's options too.
Okay. So building off of lesson number one, what is the second lesson you want to talk about?
All right. So I'd say this one, another fundamental lesson that you can take in business, in life, pretty much everywhere, which is that if you're trying to explain something to somebody, you should lead with your interests. Don't lead with your positions. Or in other words, explain why before you say what.
All right.
That can be a pretty hard concept for business people. Ewell is a great exception, and we'll get to him later. But I think a lot of business types are taught sort of the opposite way of communication, which is that if you're dealing with busy executives, you should just give them the facts. So say, we got to go buy this company, or we got to go sign this deal. And if you want to know why, I'll tell you why later. Like, here is the structure of, here are the three concise reasons why. That might work in the business world if you're on the same team as somebody. But if you're dealing with, you know, a negotiation partner, someone you're negotiating with or against, you really should focus on being clear about why you want something, what your interests are, before you just go out and start making demands. And I'd say, well, why is that? So why do you want to lead with the why or your interest? In large part, it's because you might learn something. By talking it out with someone, you might find out there's an even better option to meet your goals than the one you initially thought of. There's a sort of a classic example of this in teaching negotiation, which is that if two people want an orange and they're both saying, I need that orange, I need the orange, they both say that they need it, they can't do anything else if they don't get it. If they had stopped to talk about it, you would realize that one of them needs the orange rind because they're, you know, seasoning a cocktail, whereas mm-hmm. the other one wants to make orange juice and they actually want to squeeze it out and take the juice. So if they had been clear about their interests, they actually would have figured out a way to share it and each get what they need, and they would have both been better off than haggling over the orange. You know, I mean, that might apply to like coconut bandits on Survivor, but that's kind of a niche example.
Yeah, so you're saying that maybe Tyson and Jervis just wanted the coconut milk and somebody else might have wanted to eat the coconut husk?
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe somebody wanted to make like a coconut shell bra like on Gilligan's Island. They could have worked that out.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about in terms of Survivor. What are some examples of how this has shown up over 32 some odd seasons?
All right, so I'd say this is not just recency bias, but one of my favorite examples of seeing somebody do both the bad and the good in one episode happened this past season.
Okay.
So let's go to Khaurang. Let's go to episode 10, which was named like the quintessential Survivor quote, I'm not here to make friends.
Mm-hmm.
And think about Ty, who is torn. We've got torn Ty. He has a tight bond with Aubrey. He's excited about the possibility of working with Aubrey, but he's already working with Jason and Scott.
Okay.
And Jason and Scott, not interested in working with Aubrey. In that example, you see some really great negotiation and some great examples of leading with interest from Aubrey and some really bad examples of leading with interest from Scott and Jason.
Okay.
If you think about what Aubrey did, Aubrey went up to Ty multiple times and in a very gentle manner would always say, Ty, what do you want? What's best for you? Not only was she not leading with a position, she wasn't even focused on her own interests. She focused on Ty's interests, which is pretty much perfect. So it's one thing to focus on your own interests. It's even better if you're focused on the other person's interests. You know, just like in life, people love talking about themselves. It can never hurt if you're asking somebody else what they are interested in. Aubrey does a great job of that. She's pretty clear and consistently telling Ty, let's figure out what's best for you. What are the things that you want? Not only that, she's also offering something to Ty. She comes out and she says, I think what you're interested in is information. Ty, I can keep telling you what's going on. I've got a link to the other side of the game. And here's an example. I can tell you that Julia is gunning for you. Julia is going to look to make a move on you. So from Aubrey's perspective, that's great, you know, interest-based negotiation. She's thinking in terms of Ty's interests. She's asking him what he thinks is best for him. And based on her own sort of preliminary understanding of it, she's giving him things that she thinks meet his interests. And she's pretty right about that. Ty seems like he's pretty compelled with that offer. After that, Ty then goes over to talk to Scott and to Jason, and the experience is very, very different.
Yes. So,
Ty's really excited now. He feels like Aubrey might be a great ally, and Ty's willing to pitch it and say to Scott and Jason, hey, Aubrey might be a great ally for all of us. She's someone we can work with. She's a free agent. We can totally find a way to work her into her to our alliance. So I think, you know, he goes up to them. He's like, Aubrey, she's a free agent. She'd be a good asset to the team. I think we can work with her. What do you guys think? And Scott has pretty much the perfect response for exactly what not to do in this circumstance. Scott's quote, I went back and I took a look at this. He says, and he doesn't even look at Ty. He just looks at Jason and he goes, hey, how about this idea? At the next tribal, we take Aubrey out.
No.
Exactly. So it cuts straight to a Ty confessional, Ty saying, it feels to me like I have no say in this alliance. And if you think about it, I would understand that. His conversation with Aubrey, pretty much perfect negotiating. Aubrey's focused on Ty. She's offering things to Ty. She's talking about Ty's interests. When he talks to Scott, though, all he gets is a position. Scott's like, let's vote Aubrey out. There's no discussion of Ty. Why are you interested in that? What is it about Aubrey that would be a good fit? Actually, I'm interested in getting Aubrey out of here because she's a danger, stuff like that. None of it. Just straight list. They don't even really listen to Ty at all. They just go straight to, hey, that person that you just said you like, we are going to vote her out at the next tribal council.
Which I do think ends up working out pretty good, because based on what Aubrey was trying to say to Ty, I think he kind of misrepresented her position in coming to the guys. I don't think that she was talking about voting with them in any way. Like, I think she was talking about, Ty, you should come with us. But he was walking away from it as, oh, she wants to come with us, that her vote is up for grabs. We could add Aubrey to our alliance.
Yeah, that's sort of a great example of Aubrey was going to say sort of whatever Ty needed to hear. And even if she didn't say it, she was so soothing that he just heard it in the way that he wanted to hear it. So he was willing to protect her at that point, pretty much whatever was going to happen.
So is your advice on this just sort of trying to, you know, poll people that you are interacting with in terms of negotiation or in a survivor game of, so what do you want to do right now? Like, what would you, in a perfect world, what would be your ideal situation right now? And then sort of figuring out where a match is.
So you should do that and do something on top of that. So that's a fantastic place to start, which is always asking other people, what do you want to do? Once they tell you something, though, then you want to understand why. And you want to ask a lot of questions. You want to be doing what's called active listening. So you want to get under that layer. So if Scott came to me and said, hey, let's take Aubrey out, I think my response would want to be, okay, what is it about Aubrey that makes her a good target? Is it that you want to get out somebody that'll be unexpected? Is it that you want to get out somebody who's a really, really aggressive player? Is it that you want to get out somebody who's a challenge threat? And based on those things, can we find some common ground? Maybe for me, I don't want to get out Aubrey, but if you really want to get out somebody who would be really unexpected to the tribe, what about Joe? No one's going to think we're going to vote for Joe. I'm not even sure Joe is still here anymore. So figure out what it is that they're ultimately interested in. And then
don't make fake Scott take shots at Joe.
Sorry, I think that was edited for time. I'm sure he actually said that at some point.
Fake Scott's being a real piece of work today. He's
like, look at that guy. His prostate's not going to hold up 39 days. Let's just get him out now. But basically, it's to drill down one level deeper. So if somebody tells you they want to do something, you should never just do it. You should always understand why they want to do it. And vice versa, if you're not working with them, if somebody puts out that they want to do something, you really need to understand why they want to do it so that you can offer something that's better for you. And you can never do that by just haggling over positions. So if they say, let's take out Aubrey, and you say, no, let's take out Joe. Well, there's no real fact base behind that. There's not a good reason. It's just your will versus their will. But if you figure out the interest and you understand why it is they want to take out Aubrey, then you can start talking at a level where there's some give and take, where people might have a good reason for doing something that you don't understand, or you might be able to offer a good reason that they don't understand. And that's when things actually happen.
Yeah, and I think that this is especially useful going back to the fantasy football league also. I think it's probably a lot more effective when you are talking to the other owners in terms of, so what are you looking for right now, as opposed to sort of coming in and saying, I want X player, or I need your wide receivers, or anything like that. I think it's a lot more of a conversation starter to go with what the other person is looking for at this time and what sort of match there might be between the two sides.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like, if you're a Jets fan like you or me, we kind of always are interested in everything because our teams are terrible. But if it's your fantasy football team, you know, yeah. Like for us right now, the Jets, we desperately need a quarterback. And because, you know, Fitzpatrick's not going to sign, hopefully he will. Mm-hmm. But in most fantasy football leagues, if you need a quarterback, probably not going to be looking at Ryan Fitzpatrick to start with.
Or Geno. Yeah.
Or Geno. God bless him. Probably not going to be looking at Geno anytime soon.
Yeah.
So understand what people's interests are, and then understand what their alternatives are. So if you're the real life Jets, you probably have a lot worse alternatives than Rob's fantasy football team.
Get on the phone, shoot an email. Hey, what are you looking for? Is there a way to work together, as opposed to just sending off some sort of lopsided trade request where you are demanding the other team's best player and giving them nothing?
Exactly. And if you pair that with, you know, lesson number one, start off by looking at everybody else in the league, figure out who has, you know, the worst quarterback situation, and start there, because they're probably going to be a lot more interested in working with you based on where your position of strength is than somebody who has, you know, Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers and, you know, maybe Ryan Fitzpatrick, if we're feeling nice.
To go back to Survivor in terms of people that might have done a poor job with this, did you have any examples of people that are besides Scott who are really blowing this?
Yeah, so I think Scott and Jason were the two who really came to mind from that example. I have another good example of somebody who I think does it very well in one instance, which might be a good person to think about here. It's an example of somebody who's in a pretty bad spot and is able to play out of it by preying on the very obvious interests of one of their tribe mates.
Okay.
So here I'm thinking about Heroes versus Villains, one of my favorite seasons. And if we think right after Boston Rob has been voted out, we know that Coach has just flipped. It's just after the episode where Coach is agonizing and he's trying to win over Jerry, and he's, you know, he's down on his knees praying and is trying to think through what's the right thing to do. Boston Rob has just called him a little man on his way out. And coach is really torn. But more than that now, Sandra and Courtney know that they are on the outs. So Sandra and Courtney, never been fans of Russell. They think they're in trouble. Can't see a scenario where one of them is not the next person voted out. But Sandra knows that Russell's got a very strong interest here. Russell's got an interest in always looking like he is in control, looking like he's the leader. And Sandra has a confessional where she says, you know, Russell's the kind of person where if he finds out someone is gunning for him, he'll take them out. And to Russell, I think what Sandra realizes is it doesn't even really matter if Coach has the numbers to do that. It doesn't really matter if Coach is in a great position to win people over. She knows that Russell doesn't like people who don't trust him, and that she's got an opportunity to sort of, you know, plant a Russell seed, plant a Sandra seed, get Russell thinking in a way that he's got a strong interest that's not going to be met if Coach is still in the game.
Yeah.
So Sandra right there does a great job of, she's leading with Russell's interests. She knows that Russell's interested in power and control. She can, even if it's not real, put the idea in Russell's head that, you know, there's somebody out there who, you know, even if he doesn't have the ability to do it right now, is going to make Russell look bad, or might be, you know, setting himself up down the line to go at Russell. And it really changes Russell's thinking. Whereas Russell could have made, you know, a safer move, taken out one of the two people who he knew definitively were against him, because they'll even tell him. He doesn't do that. Yeah, a little later. But he could, if he had asked right then, I'm pretty sure they would have told him right then too. But instead, he doesn't do that. He goes after someone who, you know, probably would swear up and down that he's on Russell's side. But because Russell's got it put in his ear that that's not the case, he's willing to go after them.
Yeah.
So good on Sandra there.
One of, I think, Sandra's best episodes of Survivor through her two winning seasons to date.
That's right. Yeah. Two for two.
Two for
two. Who knows? Who knows if she'll ever come back?
Who knows?
Two for two.
Yes. Yeah. So anything else from lesson number two?
No, I think, you know, just in terms of a summary, still explain why you want something before you say what it is that you want, and try to understand what other people want. More than anything, people love talking about themselves. So give them a chance to do that. Show them that you're listening and you understand what they want, and things will come a lot more easily.
All right. Then what is the third lesson we're going to talk about today?
All right. So this is one of my favorites, and I think it's one of the hardest ones for people to do very well. It gets mentioned in negotiation books like Getting to Yes and lots of the others, but it actually comes from the Art of War. So if you go way back through history, it's called building a golden bridge for your opponent.
Okay.
And you know, there's not a lot of bridge building in Survivor or in life, but I'll explain what I mean here. If you need to get an opponent to make a major change in their course of action, so if they need to defect from their allies, if they need to participate in a blindside, if it's the business world and they need to switch from, you know, part suppliers or something along those lines, you have to help them create the story that they're going to tell themselves and that they're going to tell other people about why this was the right option for them.
Mm-hmm.
So the example from the Art of War is that there were two warring armies, and the victorious army was still fighting the losers. It was pretty clear that the losers were on their last legs, but they were still fighting. So what the army that was going to win did was they went to the soon to be losing army and offered to build them a literal golden bridge that would lead back into their home country that they could cross while retreating, so that even though it looked they were actually retreating and they had lost, it would look to their allies and their people like they were coming home successful because they had this beautiful golden bridge to cross on the way back home.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea there is to say, when someone's losing, or if you've got somebody trapped, you don't want to lord that over them. You really want to give them an opportunity to save face. You see that all the time in the business world. So you see it in union and employer negotiations. Where I live in Brooklyn, for the last 44 days, there was a Verizon strike happening outside of my window. So I saw this pretty much every day.
It's over?
It's over.
Oh,
yeah, finally.
Happy day.
Absolutely. Yeah. You also see it in presidential endorsements. So if you go back to 2008, it was really important to find a way for Hillary Clinton to state that she was dropping out in a way that made sure that she still maintained her authority and looked like a champion, looked like a winner. You know, we'll probably see it pretty soon with Bernie Sanders. I don't know what's going to happen there, but I'd imagine that it's going to be important for the Hillary folks to build a golden bridge for Bernie to come out looking like a hero to his supporters as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in Survivor, you see much the same thing. So I think Shireen talked about this in a really compelling way on a podcast she did with you pretty recently, where she was talking about her theory of who the jury votes for. And she was saying the jury votes for people where they feel okay about having been beaten by that person. That might be something about the person themselves, or it might've been that person helped people build the story in their heads about why they're okay voting for you, why they're okay with the story that you bested them. And so that's how that applies, I'd say, to life, which is that you got to give people that opportunity to save face. Business world, negotiations, presidential elections, union negotiations. And I can also think of two really great examples from Survivor where, you know, just because somebody pretty much had someone beat, they were really smart about letting them save face and gave them a good out and a good story they could tell themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up with a really good outcome because of it.
All right. What do you got?
All right. So this is one of my favorite Survivor moments ever. And it goes back to Cook Islands. So this is Yul, who has already found the idol. Yul, one of my favorite Survivor players, even though, you know, it's fair to say overpowered idol, kind of boring on TV, still great negotiator, does an awesome job managing people in his season. Yul needs to get Jonathan Penner back on his side. So a few episodes earlier, Candace and Penner have mutinied. They've left the Itu tribe and gone over to the Raros. Mm-hmm. So Itu was a foursome, had Yul, had Ozzy. The Raros had, you know, some other legendary survivors like Parvati on their team.
Yes.
So Penner has left the, you know, Ozzy and Yul side and headed over to Parvati's side along with Candace, and left Yule's team in a pretty bad spot. But Yule's got the idol. He's gotten to the point where the numbers are almost even. So there are five Raros, including Penner, and there are four Itus, including Yul and Ozzy. Yul could get Penner out on his own. He could just vote Penner out using the idol. So essentially, if everyone on the Raro team voted for anyone on the Itus, Yul could play the idol. They could all vote for Penner. Penner would go home. But Yul thinks there's a way that he can win Penner back over to his side. But he recognizes he has to do it pretty delicately because Penner has already betrayed half of everyone who's left in the game. If he were to flip back, he'd be betraying everyone else who is left in the game. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough spot for Penner. Yule handles it perfectly. So they have two different conversations that we see on the show. In the first one, Yule is just sort of asking, he's probing around, he's asking questions about what Penner's interested in. And he basically says, does it make any sense under any scenario for us to work together again? He asks that, and then he just sort of shuts up. He just listens to Penner. I'd say Yule probably already knows the answer. He knows that Penner would say, well, no, unless you have the idol. Because if you have the idol, then I'm pretty much screwed.
Unless you have the idol, and then that would change everything because then we couldn't vote for you.
Yeah, exactly. He's wearing his hat. He's saying it just like that. He lets Penner get to that point on his own. So he knows Penner needs to develop the out. He needs to come up with the story, which is
you're
that okay.
Saying what I think you're saying, and I think that you are.
Bingo. Yeah, I basically just needed to make sure that I mentioned Penner and Boston Rob in this podcast. I seeded a Russell out there a little earlier. I didn't get a Russell, but maybe later. He knows that Penner needs a chance to develop this story. If he's going to do it, Penner is the master of storytelling. He needs his story for why this is going to make sense.
Yeah.
And he gives Penner a chance to do that, where Penner says, okay, I guess if it happens that you have the idol, well, then it would be the only thing to do. It'd be the right thing to do for me to flip back. But Yule doesn't show it to him right then. He gives him a chance to think about it. He also is really, gentle about it. He's not really applying any pressure. Even though the vote is that night, he's letting sort of the external circumstances of the vote coming up be the pressure applying force on Yule, on Penner. He's ending conversations with things like, all right, well, to be continued, we'll talk again later. Mm-hmm. He plays it very gently. He lets Penner come around on his own.
Yeah.
And then finally, they have a later conversation just before the vote. Yule goes up to Penner. He shows him the idol. He says something like, our hypothetical scenario is actually reality. And he says, I'm asking you for both of our sakes to become my ally again. So he's very gentle. He's putting the power in Penner's hands and letting Penner come up with the decision that is best for Yule. You can think about that in contrast. There are many worse ways you could have done that. You could have gone up to Penner and said, hey, here's the deal. I've got the idol. Either you vote with us tonight or you're gone because we're going to put all the votes on you. In that case, Yule might have been successful because Penner's still a pretty rational guy. But it'd be much harder to think that Penner's going to vote for him. He would have been treating him pretty roughly. Mm-hmm. And, in that repeat negotiation of, the vote for the $1 million, less likely that Penner's going to want to show Yule, any support.
And at the same time, I don't remember exactly where in the timeline this fell, but Penner goes back and tries to tell his allies that I believe that Yule may have the idol. And I believe Adam and Candace are like, we looked everywhere. There's no idol. He doesn't have the idol. We would have found it. We would know if he had the idol. Stop it. You're crazy. And meanwhile, they're saying well, if you don't come with us, the votes are going for you anyway. Penner really doesn't have a lot of choices here. I mean, it's like I could either stick with my allies and get voted out of the game or go back with Yule. And I feel like that Yule at least makes him feel comfortable that he has a future there.
Yeah, Penner was really stuck with a lot of dummies on that track. He was going to be in trouble. No offense to Parvati, who is great, but she doesn't play it that well in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. Yule plays it perfectly. He knows that Penner's in a tough situation, but he still lets Penner feel like he's the one making the decision.
No, that's really great. And in terms of bringing up Yule in this instance, I feel like that you could probably also go back to the second lesson that you're talking about, of leading with interest and not positions, because at the time that Penner goes out of the game, which I believe is at the final seven back in Cook Islands, that we have this situation where you have Adam is still there and Parvati is still there. And Yule has this conversation with them of like, what can I do that will make you happy? What can I do that would potentially win you guys over so you don't think that I'm a jerk and will vote for me maybe in the end? He doesn't quite say that, but it does work out to be that way where Adam votes for him and that's the deciding vote. And they say, well, the only thing we really want is for Penner to go out before we go out. And
yeah.
Yule says, I can do that.
That's exactly right. So I figured it wouldn't be a very fun podcast if it was negotiating Survivor examples of times that Yule was great. because we could do a million of those. Yule is pretty masterful the whole season long. The example you're giving is a perfect one, right? So he knows they hate Yule. He knows that they hate Penner even more. So he's able to find something where, yeah, they're not going to win the game, but he can still offer them something to get them on his side and really win them over for later. And when you're up against a challenge beast like Ozzy, who tends to be super popular, it was pretty smart of Yule to think about what he's going to do to get people in his back pocket and get those votes.
Yeah, so Yule is really great at this, and I think that maybe sort of the rap on him, like, oh, well, he just had this superpowered idol, which allowed him to do that. I think then a lot of this stuff kind of gets overlooked because people say, like, oh, he had a Tyler Perry idol or the God idol, and that's why he won the game.
Yeah, I definitely helped, and you see it, how much it helps with the negotiation with Penner, but he also was up against some pretty good people. Like, you know, Ozzy was charismatic. A lot of people really liked him, but he crushes Ozzy. You know, Becky, Sundra, the other folks who are in the alliance as they're getting weaned down. They're all popular people. They're charismatic. And if you think about, you know, lots of Survivor votes go to the person that was the most likable. Well, I don't know that Yule necessarily was the most likable. He's a pretty quiet guy. Seems like he kept himself, you know, quite a bit when he was out there, but they respected the hell out of him. He made great deals with a lot of people. He was a really compelling person to work with. And so folks wanted to work with him.
All right. What's your scenario where somebody blows this?
Okay. So no offense to somebody I really like.
Is it me?
We're just going to talk about, we're going to talk about Amazon. We're going to talk about Christie. No, that was a good one.
I was going to bring up Christie for and kind of like with the Yule thing where at the final six, we were sort of in this stalemate of 3-3 where the three women were going to potentially vote together because Christie was saying like, well, they're offering me top three. And the three guys in myself and Butch and Matt were going to vote together at that final six spot. And I had said to Heidi and Jenna, like, well, what if we voted out Christie instead of one of you guys? And they were like, oh, OK, we like that better. That's fine. We don't even like Christie. So let's get rid of her. And I was like, OK, well, this is great. And then there's still three guys and two women. Doesn't work out in the end. But it's that same sort of idea of like their dislike of Christie was enough that they said, OK, fine, we'll do that rather than go to Ty.
Yeah, it's a great example. So like you figured out what their alternatives were. They didn't really have any good ones. You knew that they were interested in sticking it to Christy because she was annoying to deal with. And you made a move on it. It worked out great.
Yeah. Well, it worked out so-so.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this story, so I'll tell a brief aside. So I went to the Amazon finale. It was my freshman year of college.
Okay.
And I got my ticket really late. So it was while the finale was like still airing. I think I had a final at school and I had to go jump on New Jersey Transit to come over to the finale in New York. But I didn't want to miss the episode. So I put my dorm room cordless phone in front of the TV and called my cell phone so that I could listen to it on the train on the way in. And basically we get to the point where you get to tribal, you lose the stand on the boxes challenge and they vote you out. And that was it. I hung up my phone. So I never actually found out who won until I got to the reunion and was like, oh, come on. This is what happened. But it worked out fine. You looked pretty happy that night. Seemed like everybody was having a good time. I got over it. Then you came back and I don't know what happened. I assume it went great.
Don't call your phone. Call your phone.
You got it. So here's my example of somebody who plays this really poorly. I say we're going to talk about somebody who I really like, but doesn't do a great job. And that is Jim Rice.
Oh,
so this is going back to South Pacific. It does not turn out to him Rice when he tries to get Cochran to draw rocks.
Right.
And basically, if you think about it in terms of the numbers, this is a situation pretty similar to what Yule's got where, you know, he can make a compelling case to Penner that just based on the numbers, like the right thing to do is to work with me. But, you know, Jim is focused perfectly on the logic. He's saying, all right, look, we're going to put the vote on someone they'll never vote for. We'll put it on Rick. Rick doesn't have the idol. We've got, you know, more people, or they've got more people who would be eligible for the rock draw. They've got more people who will be eligible to go home than we do. So just to set this up a little bit better, right? This is at the merge in South Pacific. We've got Savai and Upolu coming together. And we're going to be in a deadlock situation where they've got equal numbers of people. They want to get to the point where, from Jim's perspective, they all stay together. on the Savai tribe, and they all vote as one against Coach and Sophie's Upolu tribe. They have won immunity, so they've got one member immune. They're going to vote for someone they're pretty confident won't have the idol, so he won't be immune. And so in terms of the math, it works out that I think there would be four people drawing rocks on Savai, and there'd be six people drawing rocks on Upolu. So again, you're drawing rocks, but at least the odds are in your favor. You're taking a risk, much like Sierra did when we were talking about blood versus water, but it's at least, you know, probability wise, it's a good decision. If you do this and you get the right side of the rock draw, your tribe has the numbers, you can mow down the other guys and march all the way down to, you know, final five or so. The way they approach this with Cochrane, who they know is kind of on the outs of the tribe, is basically they just browbeat him. The tribe gets together. Mm. They're saying like, Cochrane, are you good? Everyone good? Are we good? And Cochrane's like, I don't know. Do you want me to vote with the other team? And they're like, stop it, Cochrane. You're making me nervous. Don't do that.
Yeah.
They really don't read him right. Like if you think about how Ewell reads Penner and you think about how Jim reads Cochrane, it's night and day. It does not work out well at all.
Mm-hmm.
But do I think there was a path? Like could they have come up with a story that Cochrane could have told himself about why this was a good decision? I think they probably could have. You know, Cochrane's a smart guy. If you try to play it and say, all right, Cochrane, we're focusing on you. Like you're the linchpin. You're using your biggest strength. You're using your brain. You're playing the odds and the probabilities. And this is going to be an all-time move. You love Survivor. This is going to be one of the smartest Survivor moves ever.
Yeah.
Where you use the numbers, you drew rocks, but in a good place. And then we get the advantage. That would be huge. They don't do that. They just sort of bully him like they've, or at least like the story tells us, they've been bullying him all season. And obviously he flips over to Coach and Sophie and Albert and Edna and a little bit to Rick, although I don't know that Cochrane and Rick ever spoke at all. And the season crumbles for Jim.
Yeah. Well, this is another great example of going back to the second thing and a little bit of this as well, that I think that Coach's probably best move in his three seasons of Survivor is how he plays this Cochrane thing, because he gets Cochrane there. And there you have Cochrane, who's the super fan, who's probably somewhat starstruck by Coach in that season. You see him like wearing Coach's jacket around and sort of like it seems to be a important thing to Cochrane to sort of pal around with Coach. And Coach says to him, all right, Cochrane, I think you're playing me. I'm going to draw this line in the sand. I want you to come with me. We're going to stand up to the bullies. You're going to be Hercules. And he sort of sells Cochrane on this story that he is making the bold move and he'll be seen as sort of this hero by going over and voting with Upolu and defecting from Savai. So he sort of sells Cochrane on a story that sort of makes him tick of sticking it to the bullies.
Yeah, it's a great point. He gives Cochrane a better story than the one that Jim is giving him. He also gives Cochrane like a nickname. Like you said, he gives him the jacket. It's pretty much like the whole Coach Alliance package.
They do a great job of courting Cochrane in that season.
Oh, yeah. I give them tons of credit. Like they spotted that really well. Even if they didn't have the best offer to make on paper, they came up with the best story for Cochrane.
Another example of this, I think, might be back to another scenario I love to talk about from the end of Survivor Kagyan, when it's Tony, Cass, and Wu wins that final immunity. And we've talked a lot about in the course of discussing Survivor, the people that can make the logic-based argument and the people that can make the emotional-based argument. And Tony, I think, is really a person who is the master of being able to make that emotionally based argument. And he sort of like pitches it to Wu, where the logic based argument for Wu is take Cass. You'll win if you take Cass. And Tony gets like Wu's head spinning and tells him like, look, Wu, nobody's going to respect you if you take Cass to the end because everybody's going to be mad at you. So you'll lose there. But then if you go against me, it's 50-50. Maybe you win, maybe you lose, but everybody's going to respect you for what you did. And that Tony ends up talking Wu into losing. But it's sort of like the kind of thing where Wu is like, hey, man, even if I lose, I lost to Tony, and that's going to be in honor with all my principles and everything. And even if I beat Cass, then it would be a hollow victory. So he really gets Wu excited about losing the game.
Yeah, no one has ever been that excited about losing compared to Wu. Wu was like, I got a smoking hot girlfriend at home. I'm going to propose.
No, he seemed kind of beaten down that night of going back to the finale. If you watch it, he seems. But in the moment and going into that final two, he's like, yeah, me and Tony, we made it. We got to the final two.
Yeah, it just shows how good Tony was at snowing him that when he watches it back, he's like, oh God, how did I just do that? But in the moment, he's like, God, Tony, thanks for doing me this favor.
Yeah, I almost took Cass to the end, and that would have been such a bad look for me.
Yeah, that's pure Tony. That's the magic of Lachos.
Yeah.
Another example that comes to mind here is in Palau, at the very end game of Palau, the way that, right as we get to the end, Tom is able to pretty much convince Ian to give up the game. Again, building him this bridge, which is saying that you'll have your dignity back. You'll have your honor back.
Now, is that so much up. Tom, or is that Katie was also sort of like beating him up over that U-turn? Yeah, I guess you're right. It was kind of like both of them.
Yeah, they tag team him pretty well. They're out there for like 11 hours or whatever it is, standing on a pole the whole time, just emotionally beating up on Ian, just being like, how dare you, Ian? How dare you play Survivor like that? How could you?
We trusted you.
Yeah, if it was me 12 hours on a pole with nobody but, two smelly 39-dayers and Jeff Probst, I think I'd probably do something stupid too.
Yeah, probably. So, yeah, they really sort of browbeat him down and then ultimately got him to sort of give up. And then he didn't even go to tribal council. They just sort of like, okay, you're voted out right here. That's it. We're going home.
That's right. He got the brand enhanced treatment. He got the impromptu tribal.
Yeah. Let's not paint him with the Brandon Hans brush. No.
It's a good Survivor rule, though. If you're getting an impromptu tribal council, you probably did something wrong. Don't do
probably,
that.
Probably. Nobody's ever nailed it and had the impromptu tribal council for them where they get voted out.
That's right. That's right. We can make that rule number four.
Yeah.
don't go to tribal if you're not at tribal council.
Right. Well, at least Alicia this season had the presence of mind to say, you know what, Jeff, I'd like to go to tribal council. I would like to not just have tribal council right here on the beach.
And as you'll find out, if you ask Alicia was a great Survivor player this season.
Yeah. All right. Those are the three lessons. Is there any sort of summary or anything else you want to touch on?
Yeah. I just say to wrap it up, the people who do this well are the people who think about what these things mean from their own perspective. So they understand, what are my alternatives? What are my interests? And what's the story that I'm telling myself about, how I'm going to succeed here? The people who do this great are the people who think about other people. So they understand, what are the other people that I'm playing with? What are their alternatives? What are their interests? And what's the story they need to tell themselves to be successful? So in any good negotiation and in Survivor, put yourself in somebody else's shoes, understand how they're coming to it, and then craft your own arguments or your own gameplay to meet what they're looking for or what they think is happening. And you'll always be more successful than if you're just in your own head the whole time.
All right. Well, Michael, this is a fascinating subject, which I think we just barely started to scratch the surface. You mentioned some books at the top of the show. If people want to read up more on the things that we're talking about, what are some of those recommendations?
So two that come to mind in particular that I think are a great starting point. The first one is called Getting to Yes, and it's sort of the fundamental negotiation textbook. It's a quick read. It's a paperback now. You can check it out wherever fine books are sold. I'm sure you can find it.
Yeah.
Another one that comes to mind, because if you think about it, negotiation is really about being a good listener. A lot of the things that we talked about, understanding what other people want. There's a book called Difficult Conversations that, again, I would recommend to everybody. Totally worth reading. It'll help you understand the concept of active listening, which is one of the fundamental things that good negotiators do and bad negotiators don't do.
Okay.
So I'd say those two, Getting to Yes, Difficult Conversations, check them out.
Audiobooks are great for these as well.
Yeah, I think they both have audiobooks.
All right. And then, Michael, if people want to hear you and your podcast, by the way, this is the first time that we've had a conversation like this. Great podcasting voice.
Thanks. I feel like I'm way too close to the microphone. So
No, you're perfect. You're right there. All right.
I'm going with my rich baritone as we run through this podcast.
This is great. All right. In terms of your genius casting, of course, you and your co-host Scott Green, who we've had on a number of times to talk about different things like The Price is Right in game shows and Survivor, you guys are talking about the genius. That for the uninitiated, how much of the genius is based around these ideas?
The genius has a lot of negotiating. Like, if you're interested in negotiating, the genius is great because it's got an in-game currency and you can, sort of trade the currency for different advantages. You can get people on your side with it. It's got constant alliance building and the alliances change every episode. And it's got Korean pop celebrities. So, can't go wrong.
Yeah, what's not to like about that?
Yeah. Right.
Well, Michael, if people want to follow you, where's the best place for them to keep up with what you're doing?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at Michael Botta. I go by Mike, but my Twitter handle is Michael because I was late to the game on Twitter and I didn't get Mike Botta. So it's at Michael Botta. You can check me out there and come say hi. I'd love to talk negotiation or Survivor.
Okay. And anything else you want to point people to?
If you are interested in The Genius, we're doing sort of a season one recap now. It's at geniuscast.podbean.com. Rumor has it that we'll have a know-it-all who is not currently on the podcast with me to recap the next episodes. We'll see how that goes.
Whoa, huge get.
Could be anyone. We'll see how that goes. And yeah. I think you'll like it. So check it out.
This is a game changer.
When I was with Steven in Reno, he unironically said, this is a game changer, like three or four times in conversation as well.
He knows his lane. He stays in his lane. You get a good quote out of Steven, he's going to keep using it.
Mike, thank you so much for coming on with me. This was a lot of fun to do. We are going to be continuing our Survivor offseason. The mayor, Nick Majorano, is scheduled to be with us here in the studio coming up later this week, so we can talk a bit about his game and sort of the negotiations that went on in the back room of the Survivor jury this season. So looking forward to all of that. Plus, we're also going to be working on another show for coming into next week. Mike Bloom and I are going to rank the all-time greatest six-person tribes in Survivor history. So looking forward to that. Plus, much more of the Big Brother 18 preseason coverage. Do you follow the Big Brother, or that's too much going on, Mike?
I'll be following. I don't watch the show as often as I should, but I follow on Twitter a lot, so I try to keep up on what's happening.
Okay, so it's all happening. Big Brother 18 premiere is about a week away at this point, so very exciting time in the reality TV world. Mike, we need a hashtag.
So we talked a lot about BATNAs. And we talked about Aunt Ab. We could do hashtag Aunt Ab.
Aunt Ab. Good hashtag. All right. Looking forward to reading your comments on robinswebsite.com. And make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Go to robinswebsite.com/iTunes or search for RHAP in your favorite podcatcher. Take care, everybody. Have a good one.